Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with novelist Minrose Gwynn about her new book, Beautiful Dreamers. Minrose Gwynn is one of the South's most beloved novelists and memoirists, known for books like The Promise and The Accidentals, The Queen of Palmyra, Waiting for Snow. She was a working journalist for many years, which gave her a keen eye for the truth and the society around her. She taught for many years in the Department of English at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, but now lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And we're talking today about her most recent novel, Beautiful Dreamers. Minrose Gwynn, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you so much, Susan. I've always enjoyed talking with you so much.
Well,
thank you for having me.
I love this book so much. It is such a rich, fulfilling, dreamy. I mean, you live in this book the whole time you're reading it. It's just amazing. And I've heard you say that a novel can come to you in a flash or an image. And I'm curious if that happened with this book.
There were several seeds for this book, and I think it kind of evolved over quite some time. But to start was the Mississippi Sound, the Mississippi Gulf Coast. That whole area there has always fascinated me. I used to spend a whole lot of time in summers in New Orleans, and I rented several summers. I rented places down in Bay St. Louis to write in the summer. And most of my first novel, Queen of Palmyra, was written in Bay St. Louis. So I think the Mississippi Sound for me just holds this mystery. It has this deep, deep history, and it's a very compelling place to me. So I've always wanted to set something there. And it's in Mississippi. The Mississippi Sound is not just a setting. It's almost a character, mm-hmm. I think, in this novel. But the second seed of this was my mother, from the time she was a very young child, had a friendship with a man named David Baker, who lived in this pretty white house behind the First Presbyterian Church in my hometown in Mississippi. And he was gay. And this is back in the, 40s. Well, she was growing up in the 30s and 40s. And they were close for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And for example, when she broke her shoulder riding a horse when she was 16 years old, he brought her her homework when she was absent from school. And that night that he brought it to her and was visiting with her was the night of the historic Tupelo tornado of 1936, and in which half the town blew away, unfortunately, not my grandparents' house. And so he was kind of a character. He was the object of much eye-rolling and gossip, and he had a series of what were called houseboys. Mm-hmm. People call them houseboys. And one of them was a bad character, and he was arrested for murdering another man in an argument in the Tupelo Hotel. And so there was a sense that there was something shady about David's relationship with these houseboys, according to town gossip. So that was one thing. And David made my mother laugh. And my mother, having been divorced, left by her husband, my father, didn't laugh very much. And innocently, when I was a girl, I always thought, my mother should marry David. she's so happy with him. So that's a major seed, too, in the story. And there's some other things, too, that fed in. I've always been interested in a certain kind of character who's not only beautiful physically, but also extremely charismatic and seductive. I've only met a few of these in my life, and but they're really kind of remarkable people, I think, to observe and but not to get caught in the clutches of. And I think that's the villain in the story, Tony Amato, falls into that category. And some of these people can be, you know, really highly productive in life and wonderful people, but others of them can use those gifts that they have to create havoc and terrible events and things. So I'm always interested in that personality.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so it wasn't just a flash. With the accidentals, I heard this flash one day when I saw this beautiful bird outside my window. But with this book, it's been a long time coming. I've always wanted to write something about my mother's relationship with David Baker and his position in the town. And I, you know, it's always kind of nagged at me, that story.
Well, another thing that comes through in this book is the complex social nature of small town life. And you obviously had to think about representative people as you were creating Bellcote, this town.
Yeah.
So talk about the place in 1953 and that attraction for you.
I set the novel in 1953 because I wanted Mac, one of the main characters, the gay friend of Virginia Feather, the mother in the story, I wanted him to have an interesting history. And I was thinking it would be very interesting for him to be a physicist with the government during the 1940s, a gay man working in government at that time. Two of the books that really, really affected me and interested me in writing this was one by John Howard. It's called Men Like That, A Southern Queer History. And actually, it is a history of gay men in Mississippi.
Wow.
Only, not just mm-hmm. Southern. And how he talks a lot in there about small town life and how towns, small towns, both accommodate LGBTQ people, but they also ostracize them at the same time. And it's a very complex dynamic. Actually, Bellcote was based on Bay St. Louis,
mm-hmm.
but Bay St. Louis was a much more open space for gay men back in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And a lot of men from New Orleans would come there to be on the water, you know, to have, you know, community there. And so it wasn't as repressive as one might think in, say, a town like my hometown of Tupelo.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the 50s there was an important time period. This is right when President Eisenhower put forth the executive order, 10,450, that barred LGBTQ people from government work and also from work in government contracts. So that period is, I think the 1950s are just a fascinating period.
Mm-hmm. And you move the characters back and forth between Bellcote and New Orleans, and there are some instances of really terrible homophobia in New Orleans.
Yes, and that's very unusual for New Orleans.
Right.
Of course, very unusual. But one way that I was thinking about this is that there are always going to be violently homophobic people anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the incident that you're referring to is an incident in which there's really terrible attempt at hurting a group of gay men and also the narrator, the child, Memory Feather, and who is with these gay men. And I think maybe what incited these men to do what they did, which is try to run over the group of men and Memory in the neutral ground on Esplanade, was that they had memory with them. They had a girl with them, a young girl, a child with them. I'm not sure about that, but I do think that even in New Orleans, there can be, you know, which is one of the most gay-friendly towns in the cities in the country.
Right.
There can certainly be homophobia. One summer, I was renting a place from two gay guys from New Orleans, and they had bought the house down there and had actually built another house and were renting this little house that they rented to me. And the reason that they had left New Orleans to come to Bay St. Louis to live was that one of them had gotten shot in the leg as he was walking down the street in the Faubourg. It was a gang initiation, you know, you had to shoot a gay man. And so things happen. Yeah, they do, unfortunately.
If you're just joining us, my guest is novelist Minrose Gwynn, talking about her new book, Beautiful Dreamers. Now, this is, like many of your novels, centered on a constructed family, a family of choice. And Virginia Feather and her daughter, the beautifully named Memory, oh, I love that name so much, return home, and they're drawn there by the good wishes of her old friend, Mac, who promises her that he will give her a good life there. So the three of them make an unconventional family for a time. So talk about what that means to you and how you wrote that. I love them all three of them.
I do too. I have always been interested in alternative families.
Mm-hmm.
Being a lesbian myself, I know a lot of women and men too, who have unconventional family, have chosen family. So another part of that is, until my mother remarried, she and I lived with my maternal grandparents. You know, that's the way we lived, and it was very different in small town Tupelo. Tupelo was a small town when I was growing up. It was very different during that period. In the novel, they choose this family. They decide to be a family. And Memory, they each in her or his own way need the others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Memory needs a father. Her father has flown off in the wild blue yonder,
yeah.
You know, with the French hussy, as the mother called her.
Right.
And so each needed, Mac needed a family. He was very generous in some ways in taking them in, but he needed them. Virginia needs help.
Of all kinds.
The mother,
yes.
You know, Virginia Feather, Memory's mother needs help. She needs financial help. She needs emotional help. She's a wreck when she arrives in Belcote from New Mexico, which happens in the first chapter, of course. So they all need one another in very specific and very general kind of ways, too. There's another book that really made an impression on me, I'd say 20 years ago, and that is a book by Michael Cunningham called A Home at the End of the World.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that book?
Yeah.
It's about an alternative family, a woman and two men, and it for me it was a very moving book. I know that Cunningham has gotten a lot of accolades for The Hours,
mm-hmm.
and rightly so. But I always thought this was one of his better books. He was right onto something with this alternative family, and I that book has always stayed in the back of my mind. You know, I always think about books that affect me in certain ways, and that book really did affect me in a certain way.
Mm-hmm. Well, Virginia and Memory have such struggles ahead of them, you know, but this gives them a kind of footing in the community. Virginia works in the art gallery. Emory finally finds a school. And she is a girl who stands out anyway because of her unusual ability and her unusual appearance.
Yeah, they find a place, but that place is in some ways unstable with the homophobia against Mac kind of washing in like the tide every so often and creating certain kinds of effects. The ground is sort of
a little shaky unstable sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things about her that, you know, she is wounded, you know, she has a withered hand that she calls her paw, quite endearingly, I think. But she has an unusual talent of hearing the thoughts of animals and having conversations with them. And I have a feeling that's an ability you wish you had if you don't.
I do. I do wish I had it. And her ability to speak with animals is also born, I think, out of her need for a father and also for perhaps a mother who is more attentive. Virginia does the best she can, I think, but she is not the most attentive of mothers. Mac is much more an attentive parent to memory than Virginia is. Mm-hmm. And so, sometimes memory is in the book, memory gets quite ill at some points, and Virginia seems to be oblivious about it at certain points. So I think memory's attachment to animals and also plants is in her ability to, she transcribes what she thinks they're saying into her, you know, into her consciousness. And it becomes real to her. One of the relationships I love the most in the book is the relationship of memory to Minerva the cat.
Yes.
I got a little carried away in an earlier draft of this book, and I gave the cat chapters in which the cat didn't speak, but we just saw what the cat was doing in between the times she was with memory and the family and what the cat, you know, what the cat was up to. And finally, my agent said very gently, Minerva, I think maybe the cat chapters have to go. And I went, oh, I know you're right. I hate them. And I still have them on my computer, you know, because I really couldn't bear just to completely delete them.
You'll find another place for them. That would be lovely. Minerva speaks
at
last.
Yeah.
But what happens is these three people in their unsteady little family get blasted apart by Tony Amato, who is the charismatic character of which you speak. And also, he is not a beautiful dreamer.
No, he looks like one.
Yeah.
Mac at first thinks he's one. And then Virginia thinks he's one. And he's very tricky and seductive.
And all this leads up to a storm like only you do. Storms. I mean, it's just, you do the best weather of anybody I know.
Thank you. After Katrina, I went down to Bay St. Louis. Mm-hmm. I had cousins down there, and I had very good friends there. And when Ruth and I came into town in October after Katrina in August, we were going to try to clean up our house, and we had bought all this equipment, and I got a gas mask and everything.
Yeah.
And we walked in our house, which had been underwater for, 3.5 weeks, and just turned around and walked back out. But I said, let's go down to Bay St. Louis and see, you know, what's going on down there. And it looked like a whole big monster whale or something had come into the main street down there and just bit it off and taken it into the sound. And it was really something. In my cousin's house, there was nothing left of it except the concrete foundation. And I mean, nothing. I mean, nothing, not a trace. So it was a different kind of destruction than we saw in you know, New Orleans. But it was really, really made an impression on me. And I know how the weather can whip up, you know, in that area.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, even a tropical storm can be devastating. And so I'm very familiar with the storm systems down
right.
here. And yeah, so the book does partly end in a storm. Anyway, we have a another ending after that.
But, right.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, my guest is novelist Minrose Gwynn, talking about her new book, Beautiful Dreamers. We'll be right back. Memory, I don't know, Memory is such a wonderful character. I mean, she stands right there with Scout for me in the way she looks at the world, is brave and stubborn and undertakes things, even at danger to herself.
That's high praise. Thank you, Susan. You know, it's always interesting to me to write the story of a child, and I've done it twice with the Queen of Palmyra and the character in the Queen of Palmyra telling her story. And then I went to the third person in Promise, you know, looking from the outside. And then with the Accidentals, it was everybody telling his or her story. I'm always interested, though, in trying to produce a first-person character who is looking back on a childhood, and so to try to get the voice right. And it's very, it's sometimes difficult because you're trying to write through a child's perception that the adult is the one who's writing it. And so you have this child's voice kind of merging and coming up through the adult narrator's voice. And that is always tricky, I think. But I find it very interesting and rewarding to do.
It's tricky,
so it's
but
nice
when
to
you
return to it here,
when you listen to people talk that way, that's how it sounds too. You know, when you listen to adults remembering that young voice rises up in such an interesting way.
Yes. So we have that child in us always that rises up and speaks to us and to others and. Sometimes in very positive ways, and sometimes we can be very childish.
That's right. They call it an inner child. That's right.
Yes.
Well, it was lovely to spend some time in Belcote with you and these Beautiful Dreamers. It is such a lovely book. So.
Oh, thank you so much, Susan, and thank you for having me today. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, I can't wait to see you this fall. I've been talking with Minrose Gwynn, whose new book is Beautiful Dreamers. The book comes out August 27th, but she'll visit Octavia Books October 30th and appear at the Louisiana Book Festival November 2nd. Minrose, thanks so much.
Thank you, Susan. It's been a pleasure.
What's on tap in the literary life this week? One Book, One New Orleans and the University of New Orleans have created a new partnership to connect students to the larger New Orleans community through shared literary experiences. The 2024 selection, Black Creole Chronicles, by former Louisiana Poet Laureate Mona Lisa Saloy, will be the common reader for UNO's College of Liberal Arts for fall semester classes. And there will be additional programming curated by Megan Holt, One Book, One New Orleans Executive Director. One Book, One New Orleans is in its 20th year. Celebrate the 125th anniversary of Kate Chopin's classic Louisiana novel, The Awakening, with LSU professor Emily Toth, the leading Kate Chopin scholar. You can meet her at 2:30 Saturday, August 17th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. She'll discuss the social impact of Kate Chopin's The Awakening at the New Orleans Secular Humanist Association meeting. All are welcome. Blue Cypress Books presents an evening of trivia inspired by all things romance, featuring authors Bree Brincat and K.B. Casimir and host Mike Miley. Prizes will be awarded to the top two scoring teams. Register in advance for this event, which takes place Saturday, August 17th at 5:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Rick Jervis discusses and signs The Devil Behind the Badge, The Horrifying 12 Days of the Border Patrol Serial Killer, Sunday, August 18th at 3 at Octavia Books. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.